Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. A few weeks ago, we did a look back at the murders at Columbine High School with Brian Rohrbaugh, and the response we've had has been really great, not only from Colorado, but from around the country. In fact, a letter I just opened moments before this show, a woman in Indiana said she's been listening to those programs on the kgov.com website, and that especially the audio clips, the never-before-heard recordings of the aftermath of Columbine, are riveting. And I think that word is right. It's been riveting. Brian Rohrbaugh, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
And we have also Randy Brown. Randy, thank you, by the way, for being here and your role in helping us figure out what really went wrong at Columbine.
Oh, glad to be here, Bob.
Brian, could you give us a background about how you and Randy have spearheaded this battle?
Well, in the early days after Columbine, many people will remember my son was murdered there, and a picture of him lying dead on the sidewalk became synonymous with the Columbine tragedy, the murders that took place there. And I remember that in the first few days after Columbine, you know, there was a lot of questions by the media of what happened with the response. And the police came out and said, you know, we didn't have any warning. We didn't have any knowledge. And I distinctly remember a video clip of this guy standing in front of the cameras, holding up some white pieces of paper saying, here's the reports I filed. And that man was Randy Brown. And I didn't know him at the time. But I like the fact that he was standing there saying, don't say you didn't have anything. I've got them right here. I filed them with you. And they had denied that they had any of this information. And what happened next was absolutely unbelievable, very disheartening. I want to give people my perspective on Randy Brown so you understand. When I first heard about him, I didn't know what to think. But I was sitting between the district attorney and the sheriff of Jefferson County on a two-hour roundtable discussion when the sheriff was asked, what about these reports from Mr. Brown? And he said, I wouldn't give those any credibility. This man's son was involved in this crime. In other words, they named his son on national TV as a suspect. And let me tell you something. I believed him. I had no reason not to. And I thought they were telling the truth. And as the events unfolded, one thing became crystal clear. The one person who worked the hardest to save my son's life was Randy Brown.
Wow.
Judy Brown and Brooks Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk through that today. So, Randy, I'm pleased to have you here.
Well, nice to be here, Brian, and thanks for the nice comments. You know, it's been one of the saddest things of this whole tragedy that even though we tried to do stuff about Eric in the beginning, it didn't succeed, and I'm very sorry for the loss of your son.
And interesting that you make that comment, because one thing I've found through this is the good people who tried to do the most always feel like they should have done more, but the really bad people, the ones who didn't do their job, who lied about it, have always patted themselves on the back. Mm-hmm. And said, hey, we did all we could. We did a great job. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that good people who try to do the right thing often see that there's more that
Not
needs
much
to
more.
Be done.
To set this show apart from any number of talk radio or TV programs about conspiracy theories, the police reports that, Randy, you made to Jefferson County, that's all come out now. While they initially denied that they existed, that's all a matter of record, right? Those lies
yes.
have been completely exposed.
They sure have been. Now, Randy and I have become friends, and we're going to talk through the things that were happening at that time. And as I've become friends with Randy over the years, we have reviewed this many times. But most people won't know this story of, you know, many people have now heard how I first heard about Columbine.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like Randy to tell us what was going on.
I really want to start, I mean, since we have a couple minutes.
Sure.
You know, in the beginning when the sheriff was lying about us and the district attorney was lying about us, and actually every reporter in town except one thought that we were liars and we were doing this to be famous or to get our names in the paper, I tried and tried to contact Rich Petrone, who, well, you know, Brian knows very well, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and finally got a quick meeting with Brian Rohrbaugh and Rich Petrone over at Rich's house, as I remember. And I just want to say that that was the turning point in kind of in our lives, because at that point, finally, we got to talk and Brian listened and Brian understood that we were telling the truth. And without Brian's help and without Brian's trust at that point, I don't think any of the truth would have ever come out, because even though we had the facts and stuff, no one was listening to us and no one believed us. But at the time, Brian and one other person in all of Littleton, all of Denver, believed us. And I've always wanted to thank Brian for that publicly, so I'm doing that now.
Well, I appreciate that, Randy, but what happened there, and I should tell the audience, after John Stone named your son as a suspect, as an accomplice, in fact, as a murderer,
right?
I saw him from time to time, and I didn't know that there was any reason why I wouldn't trust him.
The sheriff.
Right. I had no reason to not believe that he was telling me the truth. And so a few weeks after he made that comment on national TV, I asked him when he was going to arrest your son. And he said to me, it doesn't look like he's involved now.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he said that privately. He didn't say it publicly. But he told me that. And then after that, I started thinking, now, wait a minute. Why isn't he saying this publicly? And I think it's time to meet with the Browns. And, of course, we were so overwhelmed in the beginning. It wasn't that we wouldn't meet with you. It was that there was so much horrible stuff going on that once things settled down and we got a little bit out of the fog and could focus on what was happening and the contradictions and that type of stuff, then I started wanting as much information as we could possibly get.
Yeah.
And so we sat down, and it wasn't really a quick meeting. You had probably 400 pages of documents that you brought.
We had a lot of stuff.
And we went through all of that and talked through it. And then Randy made this really interesting offer. He said, if you'd like to, I want you to meet my son, either with me there or without me there, and you ask him anything you want.
Wow.
And he will tell you anything. And he will go over whatever happened, whatever you want to know. And we did that. We met over at the school, and we went through and talked through exactly what happened,
mm-hmm.
which kind of brings us back to how you first heard about this.
Well, I was at a meeting in the Denver Tech Center, and my son called me on my cell phone. And he said, Dad, there's been a shooting at the school. And I acted in a very odd way looking back. I told him, you know, well, I'll be right there, you know. And then I sat back down at the meeting for about, well, what seems to me like hours now, but it was probably about 30 seconds. And I realized, well, you know, gee, this is serious. I guess I have to leave. And then so it was just odd that I didn't run out the door right when he called. I sat down. It was very odd to me. And so I went out and got in my car, and I was probably, I don't know, 18 miles from Littleton. And I drove across C-470 at literally 120, 130 miles an hour. I had a relatively fast car at the time. And then when I exited off C-470, I got on Pearson. I carefully, but I did, I ran every red light on the way to the school. I got stopped on Pierce by a policeman who, well, he was stopping traffic. He didn't actually stop me, but he was stopping traffic. And I said, you know, my son's in this neighborhood. He called me. I have to go get him. And the policeman wouldn't let me by. It was one of those odd moments you never forget, because I was thinking, now, I'm out of my car and I'm much bigger than this policeman. I can throw him to the ground and I can get by and get to my son, or what else should I do? And so I went and got back in my car and realized, you know, and in the panic, you don't think, but I realized that I could just go around him. So I just went around him and went and found my son, and my son was in a Jeep with a friend he'd been with, and I yelled at them to follow me, and we were going back to the house. Well, this is, it gets kind of confusing sometimes, but my youngest son had called me on the way to pick up my oldest son, who Brooks was the one that was waiting in the Jeep, and said he was home and he was safe. And then I called my wife and said,
And both your sons attended Columbine High School.
Oh, yeah. Brooks in there. And on April 20th, Brooks had left the east door of the school. He saw Eric drive in, and he went down to see Eric and said, hey, Eric. And he used some foul language and said, you know, you jerk or something. You know, you missed a test. And Eric said, it doesn't matter now. Get out of here. I like you. And Brooks was going out to have a cigarette and was a little confused by that, but continued to go have his cigarette. And at that point, my youngest son was in the cafeteria. So Aaron was in the cafeteria sitting probably four tables away, maybe 30 feet away from the two bombs that Eric and Dylan had put in the school. And actually, when the shooting started, and, you know, it's funny, we didn't talk to Aaron about this on April 20th, but when my youngest son Aaron gave his testimony to the CBI about 10 days later, and it might have only been 7 days later, I'd have to look that date up, Aaron saw some of the shooting and saw the bullets striking the dirt, so it's very possible, Brian, that Aaron saw Dan. So,
right. Yeah, and for the people who haven't followed the story, we have a tremendous amount of information. We know mostly what went on, even though we weren't there. We have a very accurate timeline of what went on, albeit it's completely different than the official timeline, which was nothing but a fabrication, a intentional lie.
Very true.
To fit the story that they had to tell, or that they thought they had to tell, because of the response that was given.
Let me see if I understand. Because of what appeared to be terrible inaction from the police at the beginning, they wanted to tell the story in a way that all the kids were dead by the time they got there and got set up.
Right. What they were saying is, you know, everyone had been shot outside before they got there.
Hmm.
And, of course, now things are much different than what they said, but they started with that. And from around the world, people were questioning, how could you have so many hundreds of police officers outside this building and refuse to go in?
Mm.
And we're going to talk through what was going on and how we know what was going on with that.
And now, just to emphasize that, the girl that they said was the first to be killed,
Rachel Scott,
died 12th.
That's correct. Again, that's because that was going to fit the story they told. So if you look at their so-called official report, you're going to see that it says she died first. And that's a statement they made. It's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
And tragically, there are credible eyewitnesses along with a videotape that pretty well confirms.
Helicopter videotape.
Yeah. Pretty well confirms what was taking place at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people to understand that when you consider, you're talking about people's children and you're lying about what happened to them, mm-hmm. in a crime that not only could have been prevented, but should have been prevented.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look back on this, it really is important to keep that in the back of your mind, that we're talking about innocent children. We know of multiple police officers who were on the scene who could hear the kids being murdered in the library. You know, they could hear it. We know factually that they didn't go in.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the first entry into the building was made quite some time later by a SWAT. I believe he was a SWAT member.
Denver SWAT. Well, although one of the officers was in the school, you're talking about the rescue in the cafeteria?
I'm talking about the man who was a police officer who went in that school and rescued his son.
Yeah, actually, he wasn't on the team that rescued his son, but he was there, I believe. But that was the DePews, and Matt DePew was in a storeroom with a double door in the cafeteria. And the SWAT team entered prior to rescuing anybody else, essentially, and rescued Mr. DePew's son because he was a Denver policeman.
Right. And they did this without direction from the command center. They did this based on a phone call that he received from his son.
Right.
And so I want to be sure people understand, this was not part of an orchestrated effort. Mm. You know how many feet approximately they were from Dave Sanders, the teacher who was allowed to bleed to death?
Well, technically, they were almost directly below him.
Right. With another 300 feet, they could have been right beside Dave Sanders.
Well, and analyzing that, that's a fascinating scenario. They go into the cafeteria where Eric and Dylan are not and haven't been reported in the cafeteria for, you know, actually at that time, an hour and some minutes. And they rescue the people in that storeroom and rescue the DePew child. While Lisa Kreutz is still bleeding upstairs in the library, and she lived, but she was shot and bleeding in the library. While Patrick Ireland is still in the library bleeding and has to climb out a window. And while Dave Sanders has been dragged from the science room into the greenhouse room and bled to death.
That's right.
Yes.
And all of this is taking place about the time that you're meeting up with your son, in that same time frame.
Probably a little later. I met my son around 11:50 or so. I got over there pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
But what was odd is my youngest son had called and said, "Dad, I'm at home and I'm okay." And they were watching TV to see who had made it out okay. And so I called my wife and I said, "Judy, now listen, the kids are okay. Did you hear me? The kids are okay." And I said, "There's been a shooting at the school." And she said, "It's Eric." And I knew it was Eric. And there was no question in our minds the minute Brooke said there was a shooting at the school that it was Eric Harris. We'd been dealing with him for, at that point, about a year and a half with mild threats that escalated into death threats that escalated into him shooting a window out in our garage with a paintball gun, setting firecrackers off on our porch, breaking my son's windshield, and then posting on a website that he was going to kill my son. And, well, actually, technically said he wanted to kill people like my son. So it wasn't a specific threat, maybe.
Well, I think it was specific. He named your son.
Yeah.
And I've read it. And
yeah, when you say in the vernacular, "I'm going to kill people like Brooks Brown,"
yeah,
that's pretty specific. Well, way people use "like,"
yeah,
they don't know its actual meaning anymore. That's just how they talk.
At the time when we took it to the police, we thought that was a valid threat, and they've used so many excuses now. I guess I'm accepting some of their excuses that I certainly shouldn't, of course.
Well, and let's talk about that. They kind of tried to imply that maybe it wasn't serious. They certainly told the world, "Hey, these weren't credible." First they lied and said there were no reports.
Right.
Then when you proved them wrong with that and showed the reports to the press, they said, "Hey, these weren't credible. They were internet we can't act upon," which was a lie. A threat's a threat is a threat. And they could have acted upon it. We now know that of the pipe bombs that Klebold and Harris were building and testing, that they had found remnants, which they linked to the website, which they linked to your report.
In other words, they found remnants of exploded pipe bombs in a park?
And Klebold and Harris had written on their website how they tested them, where they exploded them, what the reaction was. They had the physical evidence. They had the written evidence. So they had all of that. But more telling than that is that at the time you're meeting up with Brooks, at the time I'm trying to get to the school and in the hours afterwards, all these reports end up in the command center at some point in the afternoon on April 20th.
Right.
And they're looking at them. Even though they're going to tell the world, they don't mean anything. They don't exist. We had no warnings. They have them behind the locked door of the command center, and they're reviewing it because not only did you know that it was Harris and most likely Klebold.
Right.
Not only were their names brought out in the moments, and I mean the moments, within the first 2 minutes after the shooting started, is the first time people are talking about their names.
Yes.
It's over the radio almost instantly that it's them. But more telling than that, as soon as word gets out of the shooting, both fathers who raised the murderers, Klebold and Harris, called the sheriff's department saying, my son's involved, I want to negotiate. And again, this is factual. We have the recordings of it. This is not, you know, speculation. This is what happened. So everyone
true.
Knew it. And if someone would have called me, and I suspect would have called you and said, hey, your son's shooting someone in the school, you'd have said, you're out of your mind. I'll be right there. But these guys, they knew. There was no question.
Yeah.
They knew their kids were involved.
That's a great unknown point. That's very good, Brian. Of all the parents at that school, the only two fathers that called in were Mr. Harris and Mr. Klebold, and both of them essentially lawyered up right away, too.
Right. And when you say they called in, what you mean is they called in to say, my son's involved. No
right.
other parent out of 2,000 right. families, no other parent, no other relative called in and said, hey, I think my kid's involved.
Right. And there's some very odd behavior that extends from that, too. When they were both informed, neither of them went to the school. They stayed at, you know, where they were, and they didn't go to the school to try to help, to find out if their sons were involved. And the sad thing really is, even though the Harrises and the Klebolds both have talked to the police, we're sure, those interviews, other than one short one with the Klebold family, have never been released and never will be released because there's information in there that Jeffco is concealing.
Well, in that sense, you're absolutely right, because if we fast forward several years, I was one of a handful of people who was able to depose the Klebolds and Harrises.
Mm-hmm.
And along with those depositions were some 3,000 documents that have been hidden from the public and are, in fact, right now, along with the depositions, under a court order seal. I'm not to talk specifically about them or to tell you what they are or what they contain. And those documents have been slated for destruction.
Right.
The court had entered a ruling to destroy all of that. In a crime the size of Columbine, a court wants to destroy the documents, and they haven't been destroyed yet, but they're slated for destruction. And they want to do that to keep the public from learning any more of the truth, because when you see the documents that I've seen, what you think you know about Columbine, as horrible as it is, it gets worse.
Oh, absolutely. And then to even carry that further, and this is an odd little detail, my wife gave a deposition for those lawsuits.
Right, I was there.
And that deposition not only has never been reviewed by her, which is a right that she has to review the deposition, it was seized by the court before it was even transcribed. They seized the notes from the transcribed person.
Right, that's a good point. They wouldn't allow the recordings from the court stenographer to leave that courthouse.
Right.
So there's an audio recording that they use for backup, and then there's a computer, which is effectively the deposition in type form, where they're typing this out, and it breaks it down into the form that the courts recognize.
Right.
All of that documentation was seized. In fact, there was another case related to this, and I'm not going to go into any detail about it, but I will tell you that the law firm that worked on that case, the laptop they used was never allowed to leave the courthouse, and it's still in there in the documents. And so this is not some mistake or oversight. This is intentional.
And
this
behavior, then, Jefferson County has gone to court and used tax dollars on behalf of the Harris family.
Right, the Harris and the Klebold,
and the Klebolds,
to try to keep from releasing the right. basement videos which their murderous kids made, where they talked about the crime they were going to commit, why they were going to commit it, their racial beliefs, their hatred of virtually every race, their love of the culture of death, their justification through evolution that they're stronger, survival of the fittest, they have the right to kill the weak. In fact, they have an obligation to kill those they deem weaker than them. That, along with hundreds of pages of writing from the various members of the family, and all of these things that should be out there right this minute.
So the fact that Jefferson County Sheriff's Department uses tax dollars on behalf of the families that raised the murderers to keep more evidence regarding the crime from the public is consistent with all these other observations that they have not wanted the truth to be out about how Columbine happened.
Right, and it goes way beyond Jefferson County. It goes to the governor's office.
Absolutely.
It goes to the attorney general's office.
Yep.
It goes to the
U.S.
Attorney's office.
The Supreme Court has what they call a judiciary review committee, where they review attorneys' files and attorney complaints to see if they should be disbarred or not.
And we're going to get to that later, but in a nutshell, that group has a set of laws, if you will,
yes,
code of ethics that the lawyers have to operate under. And they're very specific.
Yes.
And if they break one of those specific laws, then they're up for some form of punishment or being disbarred or both.
Right.
Okay.
But why would these higher levels of government care? Why would they have any motivation to not want the truth about Columbine to be out?
That is a question for speculation. But it's my belief that there was so much attention, so much worldwide attention focused on it, that they wanted to protect their vanity.
The image of Colorado, law enforcement, of Colorado.
Of law enforcement.
Inept.
Well, on top of that, they wanted to defend the image of the government school system. Mm-hmm. That played a big role. And the problem is, you can't peel away the layers of corrupt law enforcement without peeling away the layers of a corrupt school system and a corrupt legal system. And the fact that Klebold and Harris were in the hands of the Jefferson County legal system, mm-hmm, the fact that Harris wrote not only that he was suicidal, but homicidal, but what'd they do? They let him out early with a glowing report. And once again, you see this tremendous corruption that leads up to the murder of 13 innocent people, mm-hmm, and a response literally filled with lies. And while you had many, many, many good police officers on the scene that wanted to do something, and in fact, some of them, like Lakewood, did something, even though they didn't have orders, you had all these people that wanted to do their job. They were being held back by a handful of people who had something to cover up. And they were more concerned not about stopping the crime, not about rescuing the injured, not about saving lives. They were concerned, how are we going to hide these documents, and what if anyone ever finds out?
Hillary Clinton made a comment just a few days after I stated something on this radio show that what they will do, they meaning our culture, the media, government officials, is they'll spin this as though Columbine is the best school in the country. That's a prediction I made. You remember what Hillary came out and said? She said, we are Columbine. In other words, Columbine is a badge of honor that we all must wear. And I think that goes to the motive of we are going to defend the system, the government, law enforcement, the government schools, and we're not going to believe that this was a colossal failure that led to the deaths of these people.
Or that it was predictable, or that there was a forewarning, that the real dangers were known. But as the years have gone by, we have continued fighting. And I've got to thank you, Randy, because first of all, I want to thank you on behalf of your son, because a good parent, when their son is accused, looks for the truth. And if their son is guilty, they demand their son be prosecuted and face a consequence. Because that's what a good parent does, because they know that consequences change behavior, and that by hiring attorneys and getting someone off for a crime, you're teaching them that everything's legal as long as you get away with it. Mm. But you didn't do that. But then you said to your son, I'm going to fight this because we're going to prove what we're saying is true. And even though I know that they ground on you so hard that there were times that you might have considered we're not going to go on, you did go on. And ultimately, you proved your son wasn't involved, and what you said was exactly true. Now all the documents have been released. But further, then you went on, and you said, you know what? My son's alive, but other people's aren't. And it's not enough for me to stop now that I found what I need to know. I'm going to help where I can help. And once again, yesterday, you were a volunteer at a fundraiser for a Columbine Memorial. And I want people to know that, because that's the character of the men I admire in this country.
Well, thanks, Brian. That's very nice to say. Thanks.
Could we do this as we move on now? I'd like to recap. Maybe Randy Brown, maybe you could tell us explicitly what is it that Jeffco knew, because you and your family had told them at the time that Columbine happened.
Well, let me explain just quickly why this is so important. If you don't know everything that happened at Columbine, if you let the police get away with lying and you let the district attorney get away with lying and the truth never comes out, Columbine can happen again and again and again, and no one will know how to stop it. You can only prevent things that you can understand. So that's why it was so important and is still important for Ted Mink to, who's the current sheriff of Jefferson County, for Ted Mink to release the files so that everyone, and that means Brian, and that means you, Bob, and that I can read the files, and I can read Mr. Harris's notebook, which it's now been made public that he has a notebook of his, the behaviors of his son that's been released, and Ted Mink has talked openly about it.
But it hasn't been released.
Just its existence.
Its existence, right. And some of us have seen it and understand it's imperative that it's released.
Yeah. That and all the other lies they've told, all the paperwork, all the documents need to be released, including the full ballistics, because what people don't know is the police fired into the school during this 80 rounds, 85 rounds. It depends on, you know, what numbers you want to believe. And they've never released the ballistics information on all of that. So we truly do not know at this point if they shot one of the innocent children in the school. We know they fired into the library. Their bullets ended up around the perimeter of the library, in the library doors, in the window. They fired down the main hall of the school. And people need to understand all this happened, and they need to have all the facts so that they can learn from it. That's the main key, and that's why it's so important that all this information get out. But what we knew at the time, we reported Eric Harris for, he was running missions in 1997, and he put it on his website. He wasn't threatening Brooks at the time, so we went to the police with that information anonymously in 97. In 98, we found out that he was building pipe bombs. My wife called the police after we reported this and said that he was purchasing weapons and investigating purchasing weapons. He threatened my son's life. And so we went directly with the police to that. We didn't go to the Harris family or the Klebold family because we talked about it for an afternoon and kind of argued about it, because the Klebolds were friends, but you can't go to friends and go, look, Eric and Dylan are, you know, building pipe bombs and they're talking about killing my son. Because the friends are going to convince you that they can handle this and that it's something they would take care of. So we went to the police. We took it what we thought was to the next step, the necessary step to prevent anything further from happening. We took it to the police three times. They lost it the first time. The second time they couldn't find the file. We went over and finally they found the file. And when we pursued that, it was so bad that the bomb squad guys came in and showed us what pipe bombs looked like, that they're made of plastic and PVC pipe and they're made of pipes with threading on the end. So the police knew all of that ahead of time. The police also knew that they'd broken into a van, that they were arrested for that.
Randy, what do you mean The police knew that when the bomb squad guys showed you pipe bombs? What did they know?
Well, this was March of 98. They knew that we had reported that they were making pipe bombs, and Eric described on his site what the pipe bombs were. He even named them, and he described how he made them. We knew where they were getting the gunpowder for them from a fireworks stand that they worked at. And so, you know, all that information the police had in March of 98, a year before Columbine.
And they had an exploded pipe bomb.
Oh, yes, they did.
They had linked to it. And, of course, it was years and years after this crime before we learned that.
2 years.
But we have the documentation that proves the search warrant they drafted was based on all of this information and the exploded pipe bomb, which fit the description Klebold and Harris's wrote on the website, and the damage caused by it, everything fit. They knew it was the same pipe bomb. Something else most people don't know, these two had a habit of writing the name of their pipe bombs, writing a name on the outside of their pipe bombs. And the police have never admitted it. I've long suspected that the name given to that pipe bomb was actually written on the outside of the case. We know factually that from Columbine we have the evidence pictures of the pipe bombs with the names on them. We can link those back to the basement videos where they displayed those pipe bombs with the names on them.
Right.
And so I have a suspicion, although not a confirmed fact, that beyond all of the other physical evidence and the written evidence, they had a name on the pipe bomb they discovered in the field, too.
And that's information that essentially we gave them in March of 98. And Columbine happened April 20th, 1999. And what's fascinating, on April 20th and for a couple weeks thereafter, they're denying that we had a report. They're denying that we've ever talked to them. They said there was no report. But while they're saying that, on April 20th, they actually used the information that we gave them in March of 98 to prepare the search warrants for the Klebold home and the Harris home and another home. And so while they're saying we didn't do anything, they're using our information to prepare the search warrants they used that day.
And this is really important because, again, it was a long, long time before we learned this.
Yeah, about 2 years.
Yeah. The search warrants that they were getting on the afternoon, evening of the 20th and the days that followed included your reports. And publicly, they were saying Brooks is a suspect.
Right.
And that you're a liar.
Right.
And that you didn't do these things. In fact, they went further. They said at one point, you contacted them but didn't want to sign a report, so they couldn't file it.
I remember that in the media.
Yeah.
And, of course, now we have those reports, and I distinctly remember not just your signature. One of them even has Brooks' signature on it.
Brooks is on the complaint that we filed. His name's on the complaint. So they're saying that the boy that turned Eric in to the police, through me, I mean, I filed the actual report, but he gave us the information. And they were saying that he was a conspirator in this and was involved in it, which is, you know, pretty absurd.
So help us recall, how was it that Sheriff John Stone denied that these reports had ever existed? What did he say? Was it outside of the Columbine school grounds at a press conference?
I think what you have to realize is there was so much media attention that there were multiple press conferences every day for the first month. Mm-hmm. And the first time I heard him name Brooks as a suspect and try to discredit Randy and Judy was a few weeks after at that roundtable discussion that CNN aired live. Mm-hmm. And so that was the first time I heard about it. But we have now videotapes from multiple press conferences, one that had Lieutenant John Kickbush standing there denying that the Browns had made reports. And who was behind him? Do you remember, Randy?
District Attorney Dave Thomas.
Who was nodding his head the whole time.
Right.
Agreeing with this, that there weren't reports, they didn't have advance notice. Now, I've got to stop and go back a little bit because in the hours and days after Columbine, there was a meeting of the government officials in Jeffco.
Right.
And Dave Thomas was one of the people at that meeting. And we have some other names here. Well, the people.
The importance of this meeting, this is a very important meeting. Well, and Brian has said this comment, well, Danny wasn't even buried at the time, was he?
Danny wasn't even picked up off the sidewalk at the time they first started the conversation. They left him laying there 27 hours.
Yeah.
He was the first body they picked up. And they told Rich and Sue, Dan's mom and stepfather, that all the kids had been booby-trapped with bombs, and that's why they couldn't move them, because mm-hmm. the bomb squad had to disarm them.
That was a lie, by the way.
That was a lie. We know factually it's a lie. In fact, we even have some videotape now of where they moved them.
Yeah.
So,
in other words, they moved them right away.
They moved them to check them within the first hour and a half or so. Mm-hmm. So we know there wasn't a pipe bomb. And by the way, they told all the families that. They were telling everyone that the kids in the library were booby-trapped, that there was bombs, you know. And, of course, it was a lie. And it was to try once again to say, hey, there's a reason for the way we behaved. Mm-hmm. But the reason they behaved that way is they had a more important agenda.
While the children are still in the school and Brian, your son, is on the sidewalk, they're having a meeting, and around 20 officials of Jefferson County had a meeting, but just the fact that they had a meeting is fascinating. As a county, as a police force, and as a school district, they have no liability. No matter what they do wrong, you can't sue them. They have no liability.
Well, they have governmental immunity,
right.
Which protects them for all but the most outrageous conduct. The court has to find their action shocking to the conscience, right. which would imply that the court has to have a conscience and there's a clear right. history
right.
that the court doesn't have a conscience.
And so, all the lies that have come out now have been thoroughly documented. They are shocking to the conscience, but you pointed out the court has none.
We presented the court with 28 material lies said to us and about Dan. And the court said, oh, no, that doesn't reach the level. And 28 material lies, not 28 minor details,
yeah.
28 material lies. And the court said, yeah, forget that.
And covering up the evidence that a mass murder of mostly children should have been prevented.
Right. Tampering with evidence is a crime. The false testimony they gave in court is a crime. They were altering a crime scene, a murder scene, and lying about the evidence that they had and that they had collected. All of those are crimes. Now, at this meeting, I've got a list of some of the names. I want to run through them and get your comments on them, Randy, if I could.
Sure.
Let's start with Sheriff Johnstone. At the time, he was the sheriff of Jefferson County. I know that after he left being the sheriff, the youth stumbled across him in a Costco bakery and took a picture of him, which I still chuckle about when I think about the newspaper running that story.
It's actually kind of sad. He went from being a county commissioner in Jefferson County to getting himself elected sheriff by using his influence, all the while reportedly being an alcoholic and having drinking problems. And
that was very common comments of the people in the media. I mean, every time I did an interview, off the air, before the interview started, after the interview, there'd be a comment, what bar's the guy at, whatever. Yeah. I mean, that was kind of like the well-known side of this guy.
But then many years later, five, six years later, after Columbine, he had ended up, you know, he was unemployed and couldn't get employed because he'd been so disgraced by his behaviors at Columbine and the lies that he told, and people finally realized he was lying, that he was a baker at a Costco. We saw him. He was taking donuts out of a – and not that there's anything against being a baker. But
not at all.
Certainly nothing wrong with that, and that certainly
– that's an honorable profession.
I was going to say, he was more honorable doing that
than anything
what
he did
as
sheriff.
A sheriff.
Absolutely, yes.
And so he was a sheriff at the time, and he ends up years later out of law enforcement. That's good news for the public.
That's true.
The next guy on my list, Undersheriff John Dunaway. Undersheriff at the time Columbine took place.
Yes. Well, in my opinion, John Dunaway lied about my son and lied for years about what happened. He's very familiar with what happened, had to be as the undersheriff.
In fact, his influence is so great that there are people today in Jeffco that still say your son was involved.
No, absolutely. Yeah. People that still work at the sheriff's department still say that Brooks is involved. And
right.
In spite of all the
yes. evidence, all the recordings, the 53,000 pages that we've forced them to release.
Right.
And all of that, the mountain of evidence, the fact that from the very first moments, your recorded statements recorded on audio and video in the media have turned out to be not only true, but absolutely accurate. And yet, they're still saying that.
Yes.
Okay, so the next person, District Attorney Dave Thomas. He was the district attorney at the time of Columbine.
I have to tell you, Dave Thomas is possibly the best liar I've ever come across. He can lie to your face to you, and you believe him, and he seems so sympathetic, and he is so evil and dangerous underneath. It's an amazing thing.
In fact, everything we have uncovered about Columbine leads back to Dave Thomas's desk one way or another.
I believe
absolutely
it does. Yes.
Everything.
Yes.
And at some point during these shows, we're going to play a clip from a Captain Harris who says what he remembers from that secret meeting the hours after Columbine. And we're going to talk about that, too. Now, Dave Thomas today, what is he doing?
Well, actually, Dave ran for Congress. And unfortunately for Dave, Mr. Salazar's grand jury investigation proved that Dave Thomas was a conspirator, was at the secret meeting and lied about it, and proved that Dave knew about the cover-up and the lies from the beginning, and he kept those lies as part of him. And so Dave lost his congressional seat. The Democrats were pretty upset about that.
Right. In fact, he's run for a couple different things. But after the grand jury report that Attorney General Ken Salazar held looking for what turned out to be your 1997 report.
Yes.
And why it was lost, I don't believe for a moment it was lost, but it did turn up years later. Anyhow, so Thomas loses that. So you would think that everyone would see him, would say, this is a really bad guy. He shouldn't be in government. What's he doing today?
Well, he was unemployed for a short time and said he was even going to go into real estate and consulting and stuff. And then all of a sudden, we believe that a friend appointed him to be head of the District Attorney Council. That is kind of a figurehead position that handles and helps the district attorneys all over the state.
Throughout the state of Colorado, has a great deal of influence. Yes. So think about this.
So this
the
liar,
criminal of
this,
Columbine.
This liar, this coward, this man that lied to me, lied about my son, and continued these lies until Attorney General Salazar at the time revealed his lies, is now, received a promotion.
We're speaking to Brian Orbaugh, whose son Danny was murdered at Columbine High School, and Randy Brown, whose son Brooks was the first to bring to the attention of his family and then the authorities that Harrison Klebold were making threats and pipe bombs and even death threats. And then Jefferson County knew about this, but for reasons we're not certain of, decided to not proceed and execute the search warrant.
I just wanted people to know the importance of what this secret meeting and the end result of it was. Dave Thomas and these people have this secret meeting. And at the time, families like Brian and other people who had lost children were trying to find out the truth of what happened. And they're even going through the newly released 11,000 pages before a deadline, trying to make sure they can file. And they're not filing to get money. They're filing to find out what the truth was about how their children were killed.
And the 11,000 pages you're mentioning, I went to court and testified that we thought we might have claims for wrongful death against Jefferson County, but we didn't know because they'd been promising the report for several months and had never released any evidence. And we asked the court, release this evidence so we can see what happened here because they won't tell us. And they testified that there were about 13,000 pages, and since we didn't want information on the bombs, there'd be about 11,000. The court agreed to review that. And, of course, as we now know, we're over 53,000.
Yeah, so the 11,000 pages was another lie, obviously, because they have much more than the 46,000, 48,000 or whatever it is that's been released still in their offices. But the point is, people like Brian, he was not trying to sue to get money. He was trying to find out what had really happened so he would know how his son was killed. And these people that attended this meeting, they essentially conspired to keep that information from him, which certainly had a deleterious effect to your lawsuit. If you don't have all the information, you can't go to the judge and say, look, here's what we know.
And just a side note, do you know in the other school shootings, and tragically there have been many of them.
Many.
But do you know in the cases where the police have been forthright and honest and that the people who raised the murderers have been forthright, honest, and decent, lawsuits haven't been filed?
Well, and Brian, actually we had that opportunity to do that initially. If you'll remember, we had a meeting brokered with the Klebolds where you were going to meet with them and talk to them, and they backed out on that.
And in return, so everyone knows, I offered them that I would sign any waiver that their attorney drew up preventing me from taking legal action against them.
Yes.
Yep.
And just if they would talk with you so you could find out what actually happened.
That's right.
Right. It's never been about money. It's just been about finding the truth.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. So, Brian, you've brought another series of recordings. Why don't we begin to listen to them?
Okay.
Again, this is Jim Burkhalter, who has the white shirt on. He's an investigator in my office, and he's been an investigator here for the last four or five years. And prior to that was a detective with the Denver Police Department in their homicide unit, their polygraph unit, bomb squad, and a whole variety of other things. He and I have known each other probably for the last 25 years. Kathy Sasek is the assistant district attorney, which is the number two person in my office, and the person who I rely on most frequently to help me make difficult decisions. So I thought you ought to know who's here. The last thing I would say is, as probably all of you know from getting involved in the court system, there is no confidentiality in what we do. If we all sit here and talk about things and somebody wants to drop a subpoena on you or me or anybody else, we will get to repeat all of it. So that's just kind of a warning, because I feel obligated to do that, because some of you are still involved in civil litigation, and I just want everybody to understand anything I say, my staff says, you say, as far as I'm concerned, is public comment.
Okay. So you just heard Dave Thomas introducing people. I want you to pay attention to a couple things he said. Kathy Sasek, his number two person, assistant district attorney. We're going to get to her in just a minute. But this meeting took place after the court dismissed our lawsuits. And Dave Thomas said he wanted to help us get answers. And so, once again, he's pointing out an investigator he's known 25 years. Well, you might think that's a good thing. Sadly, knowing Dave Thomas, that's not a very good thing. And then, of course, Randy, as you chuckle, the threat at the end, which was basically, gee, someone might drop a subpoena on you, so you better be careful what you say. He did leave out someone might record the meeting.
Yeah. Well,
but
yeah.
You don't need a subpoena to hear this.
Right. Yeah, and you were recording these, and you were very smart to do so. I wish we had done so. What I laughed at was his comment that everything they say is public. He's saying this knowing that while he's telling you this, the secret meetings and all their content had never been released, and he was keeping that secret a lie. They kept that for 5.5 years after Columbine before we found out about it.
That's exactly right. So at the time, we didn't know about secret meetings.
No.
And as well as Dave Thomas being at those secret meetings, the assistant Kathy Sasek, which he just gave the glowing report that he doesn't make a tough decision without her input, which tells you that's probably a true statement. And she knew as much as he knew and was probably in on most of the decision-making that ultimately led up to the murders at Columbine.
Now, based on his comments, you can't come up with any other conclusion but that.
Okay, let's listen to another.
I come to meetings assuming that everything I say will be repeated, may be tape recorded, and will be repeated to the media.
Okay. This is
a good assumption.
A different meeting, and if you heard in his voice, this meeting's a little angrier because some new information's come out, not the secret meetings, but he's going to be a little more defensive in this one.
And Brian, I have to tell you this is the most honest thing I will ever say to you.
I thought you'd appreciate that because the man has never said an honest word to me in his life. But I thought you'd like to hear that.
This is the most honest thing I'll ever say.
Yeah, now
to
think
you.
About that. The I most
couldn't utter
honest.
Those words.
Right.
Because that means, look,
you're
I
dishonest.
Normally lie to you, but this is the most honest thing.
I'm sorry, and I'm just trying not to laugh out loud again.
Yeah.
Well, listen, this is all tragic, and yes. Innocent people suffered the most. And sadly, when adults are wicked, the children are always the victims. But we have to laugh about some of this because we can't keep going.
No.
If we can't look back at it and see how these people behaved and be honest, at least with our emotions, that it's incredible the things they did.
And when Randy just said that it was 5.5 years later you found out about these secret meetings, no longer secret, the public sort of gets worn down. And we found that true with national politics. Scandals erupt, criminal behavior takes place, and eventually people are too tired. Too many other things have happened, and they don't care anymore.
Right.
And so people, as long as they could stonewall and lie long enough, then they tend to get away with it.
That's true. The value of these recordings and the reason that we're playing them here for the first time that they've been heard anywhere is to help people understand the gravity of what took place, as well as realize and these people are still out there in the public sector, many of them. And it's important. You need to know how they behaved because you'll know a tree by the fruit it produces.
Well, and recording them is something Brian was doing that I don't think anyone else was doing at the time and didn't have the foresight to do. As an example, this is something everyone should do when they're dealing with the police, the FBI, the district attorney, the sheriff. Record the conversation so you have proof of what happened.
In fact, I'd like to bring up something you just reminded me of. After they accused your son publicly, they asked you to submit him to a polygraph.
Yes, and actually, as an odd coincidence, we were working with an investigator for the Klebold at the time. Their investigator was doing some research, and I believe it was the Klebold attorney that told us never to let them do a lie detector test. It turns out that 80% of lie detector tests are technically inconclusive. 10% are fail, 10% are pass. And they even went so far as to say that, well, they would have their FBI guy do it, and they would make sure that they'd slant it and make sure that Brooks passed okay. So that was
right.
just an absurd
now,
suggestion.
Let me stop you for a minute. You just said the FBI
yes.
told you that they would make sure Brooks passed it.
Yes.
But, of course, you had already been lied about. Brooks had already been lied about and lied to.
Right.
So you didn't fall for that. Did Brooks ever take a polygraph?
Well, yeah, we wanted to do a lie detector test because we had nothing to hide. So Brooks did a lie detector test that we paid for with a private lie detector test company. I forget what it was called now. And they were just great. They gave the lie detector test.
And let me ask you, what questions? Most of the public would want to know one particular question, and I want to know if you ask it. Was this question asked, Brooks, were you in any way involved in this crime?
Yes. Of course, I was not in the room. That's a private thing
right.
to do, but we saw the results. And you have to remember, too, Brooks was very shaken up. This was early on, and we were just upset.
Anyone would be
yeah.
being named nationally as an accomplice to murder.
Sure. But they asked him all kinds of questions like that. And he had trouble with one question, which was something about, did you know about the building of pipe bombs or something? And, of course, he knew about the building of pipe bombs, because he reported them for that. You know, he never went on the missions with them and never built them with them. So I think he had a problem with one question like that. But essentially, he passed with no questions.
Right. And, Bob, your audience will appreciate Randy Brown's honesty.
Mm.
You know, they don't get that. We certainly never got that
right.
from our government officials. The fact that you don't point out just the glowing part, you just tell it the way it is.
Yeah, and of course, lie detector tests are not conclusive. It's not accepted in
right.
court, and rightly so, but it does tend to help bring truthfulness out of the person being tested. They tend to answer questions more truthfully just because they think if they lie, they'll be
right.
caught.
Well, that, and the fact that it also shows the intent. When someone says, okay, I'm going to submit to a lie detector, I won't let you do it because you're already a proven liar. But these are the questions that we ask. Here's the results. You know, that says we don't have anything to hide.
Yeah, and it reminds me of your first meeting when, Randy, you said to Brian, you can talk to Brooks with me there, with him alone. And that's the time when Brian ended up trusting that you were telling the truth. And that's the kind of behavior that leads to trust versus the kind of behavior that stonewalls and starts an immediate defense.
Well, we had certainly been advised by many people to not speak and to get an attorney, and we just didn't see any need to. So,
guys, of course, this is fascinating, but we're running out of time. I'd like us, if possible, to continue on tomorrow's show.
That'd be great.
Fine with me.
Randy? Okay, thank you, guys. I want to recommend to you in the audience two of our resources that Brian Rohrbaugh produced. One is when he spoke at the Colorado Right to Life March 2006. Just an extraordinary DVD tying in the murders at Columbine to our culture of death and how our government says that you have the right to kill unborn children. It's a startling DVD. You will absolutely love it. It is truly riveting, to use that word again. If you purchase this from us here at Bob and Yurt Live, one copy is $9.95. You could get three of these DVDs for $19.95 or five for $24.95. So call us at 800-8-NYARTS. That's 1-800-836-9278. And let us know. I'd like to order the Brian Rohrbaugh DVD, either one copy, three, or five. And then we also have a CD audio recording. Brian and his wife Lisa spoke at a medical ethics conference at Memorial Hospital in Colorado Springs. And that talk in front of, what, a couple hundred pro-choice doctors and medical ethicists was just startling. You'll want to hear that, too. That's $9.95. And, of course, the revenue goes to help keep Bob and Yurt Live on the air. So thank you for tuning in, and check out kgov.com.